Sometime to have a dime. Sometime to have $10. I'm gonna pay little Maggie's fine. Flower makes bloom, pretty stars are made to shine, pretty women were made for loving, little Maggie was made for mine. Watch and change. Little Maggie's gonna dance for daddy. Listen to this old banjo ring.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstead Show, the radio show where we talk about what, Colin?
Comics.
Comics. And today I'm joined by Ken Bozum. And that was some Ralph Stanley we're listening to. I forgot the name of the song. Hopefully our guest, Mr. John Bell, knows. John, do we have you there?
You do.
Excellent.
Greetings.
Greetings. So do you know the name of that song? Because I forgot to write it.
I do not. But it's great stuff, isn't it?
That was a rip-roaring tune. We were all kind of doing a little jig. Ken was blown on the jug, the wine jug.
The virtual jug.
The virtual jug.
Yeah, yeah.
Colin had the washboard.
Well, I'm glad that I introduced Colin to Ralph Stanley.
There we go. He's a better man for it.
I think so.
Now, just so all the listeners in Vancouver know, and elsewhere, because we are online, www.citr.ca, John is the author of a couple of books. The main one we're going to discuss is Invaders from the North, How Canada Conquered the Comic Universe, which covers both modern-day alternative comics and some really odd Golden Age comics. And for those that aren't knowing of comic book terms, Golden Age is a reference to 1930s, 40s, early 50s, and early comics in the 20s? I don't know. That's platinum age, isn't it? And, yeah. And, the other book that Colin was holding up so beautifully for me is Canuck Comics, edited by our guest today, John Bell, and with an introduction by Harlan Ellison. That was the reason I said it like that. And just so people know, if you're having problems hearing either Colin or Ken, they unfortunately are sharing a mic. So we appreciate your donations because obviously some things need fixing here. So
it sort of feels like we're the Andrews sisters kind of sharing a mic.
It is kind of. A lot prettier than the Andrews sisters.
Well, clearly. That goes without saying. Right?
So tell us about Invaders from the North, John.
Well, it represents sort of the culmination of about 30 years of research and collecting on my part, trying to document the history of Canadian comics from about 1900 through to the present. The focus is on English-Canadian comics and very much on the comic book as opposed to the strips. And that's a very important aspect of our comic art. But I decided that I would focus on comic book publishing.
Because comic strips, there's actually quite an extensive history in itself that would probably make up a book.
It's another book. And French-Canadian comics, definitely another book.
I've been critiqued once when I said I was the and since we're the only radio show in Canada about comics, and someone corrected me and said there's actually two in Quebec.
Of course.
So we're the only English radio show about comics in Canada.
One has to be precise.
There we go. We are in a multicultural country. God bless. Colin?
Oh, I was just saying, now, I don't think a lot of people would realize just how much of a history that comic books have in Canada. Could you tell us a bit about the Canadian whites?
Well, the whites emerged during the war years when the U.S. comics, due to some fairly complicated economic issues, are blocked from our newsstands. And it's not just comics. The legislation actually blocked all publications that they described as, I think it was fiction periodicals, fiction magazines, and that included comics, but also included pulps. So during the same period, from about 1941 to 45, we have our own indigenous pulp magazines emerging too, which is interesting. And that's another book. But so what happens is that there are a number of publishers active in Canada at this point who have been watching the success of American comics, particularly in the late 30s. And they recognize very quickly that there is a real opportunity here. And so they rush to fill the vacuum. And there are several firms in Toronto, one in Vancouver, and another one in Montreal. Those are the main publishers. And over the course of 41 to 42, they all begin to develop comic book lines. And the comics were referred to by the kids at that time as whites because most of them featured color covers and black and white interiors. I think they were featuring black and white interiors because it would be difficult for them at that time under the wartime regime to get to have access to color inks and that sort of thing, right? There were real difficulties with obtaining paper and all that. So, there was no competition, so why not publish in black and white? It would be a lot cheaper. And so we see the emergence of our own comic book industry during that period. And for these are the only kids, the ones that were growing up in 41 through to 46, who actually grew up with their own uniquely Canadian comics and were not really exposed to the American comics, at least not to the same degree as the kids before then and after, of course.
And the first Canadian comic was actually out of Vancouver, wasn't it? Wasn't
That's right.
Maple Leaf Comics?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the major, probably in many respects, Maple Leaf, which published, I would argue, is what is really the first Canadian comic book.
Mm-hmm.
That same year that they, or the same month rather, that they issued Better, a firm in Toronto packaged some strips and reprinted them. But they did it in a tabloid format. So the first comic book, and in keeping with the format that we're all familiar with, did come from Maple Leaf in Vancouver. And in many respects, their comics were probably the most polished of that golden age period.
Right.
What were some of the... because in that period of Canadian, I guess, comics renaissance... would that be a good term, guys?
The first and last time Canada had a comics industry?
Well, we had the newsstands, you know, and that was the first time that our comics dominated the newsstands.
One of the interesting things in your book is the coverage of the Golden Age superheroes.
Yes.
And Ken's eyes are lighting up.
I'm lighting up just because it thrills me that we beat Wonder Woman with a superheroine.
Yes.
Who was this superheroine?
Nelvana of the Northern Lights.
What was so special about Nelvana?
Well, what I try and do in the book, you know, it's the book is very much a survey, but I thought that it would be interesting to, if you read it, I mean, I'm trying to cover a lot of territory, both in terms of geography and in terms of chronology, you know, about a century of comic art activity, and in all regions of the country other than Quebec. But I thought it would be useful to try and focus on one theme and just for an in-depth study. And so I chose to look at what I call national superheroes. And these are superheroes that are uniquely Canadian, that represent Canada in some way. And some of the most important ones appeared during the war, and that included Johnny Canuck and Nelvana of the Northern Lights and Canada Jack. Nelvana was interesting because she was the first of these national superheroes, and also she was an extremely powerful superhero, and a very interesting figure. Her creator was an artist by the name of Adrian Dingle. And unlike a lot of the artists who were active during that wartime period, because a lot of them were just kids, teenagers, who were working freelance for various companies, and many of them still going to school, Dingle was an accomplished graphic artist. And so his artwork really stands out. It's among the most sophisticated of that that period in Canadian comic art.
Well, we should keep in mind, even though the Canadian Whites were, you know, a uniquely Canadian phenomenon, it doesn't necessarily mean that most of them were any good.
Right. Absolutely. Well, you've got to remember a couple things. One is, yeah, you've got these young kids drawing them, and if you follow through the products of almost all these publishers, you know, they really grow and develop over the 4 year, 5 year period, become you know, much better in terms of storytelling and the quality of the artwork. But you know, that shows. The other thing, of course, is the target audience. They're being drawn for kids, not for adults. And that shows as well.
Now, Captain Canuck, someone I want to bring up.
Yeah.
Because he's one of the more known Canadian superheroes, if people are going to, you know, other than, say, Wolverine or something.
Yes.
Like that. He's got his own little fascinating bit of history, because one of our local cartoonists worked on Captain Canuck for a while, and hearing some stuff. Captain Canuck is a Mormon superhero, from what I understand.
Well, in some respects, yes. Yeah, he is. He has those values are certainly evident, particularly in the early issues that were drawn by Richard Cumley, the creator. Canuck is interesting in that he's sort of the hero that will never die, but you know, he doesn't have any kind of sustained run, and yet people are kind of vaguely aware of him, even though they may never have read a Captain Canuck comic book. He's very much become a national icon, and he kind of exists almost independent of the comics.
Wasn't there a return of Captain Canuck?
There have been several returns.
Recently.
I think there was one even just last year, actually, or maybe even early this year.
And I think
he just keeps coming back.
He returns and he goes away and he comes back.
Hey, he's like, on a stamp, isn't he?
He is on a stamp.
So
yeah.
He's Nelvana.
Yeah. But again, maybe that sort of points to a vacuum, right? I mean, maybe there's a desire out there, maybe even a need, heaven forbid, for Canadian superheroes. There's certainly, I think, a desire, right, for people who are interested in that genre. I think that there's, you look at the interest in Alpha Flight every time, you know, it returns. There's a great hullabaloo. So I think there is a desire. But the fact that that Canuck and the other Canadian superheroes haven't really survived, that may say something about us. You know, maybe superheroes, it's difficult for a middle power to sustain superheroes. Maybe you need to be a superpower.
I think there was actually, when I was flipping through Invader from the North, I can't remember if it was something you said or if it was in Seth's foreword, but there was something about how possibly Canadians just don't trust the sort of all-powerful figure that's supposed to look out for them.
Well, I think we are, yeah. I think there's a kind of a skepticism in Canada, right? We're a little distrustful of the notion of heroes, and maybe particularly all-powerful heroes, right? I think we're more skeptical in some respects. that's why perhaps we've really, our forte has been poking fun at superheroes.
But really, I think more than that, the simple having to compete with the American comics industry has been the most difficult thing for Canadian comic publishers to overcome.
That's really shaped our history in to a large degree. But the thing we do have to remember is Canadians have been extremely active in American mainstream comics as well, and they still are.
Superman.
And we've played, Canadians continue to contribute to the creation of superhero comics in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Todd McFarlane, one of the, bigger names in comics, lived in Vancouver for quite a while at one point. Now he's relocated
to... John Byrne. Joe Shuster, of course, many, many others.
But the interest of the Ink Studs and is the alternative section of comics is where I really see a lot of stuff has exploded as far as that whole, Canadian comic identity. I guess that's what I'm looking at. To me, that seems like the when you really look for what are Canadian comics, would you agree that it is the alternative independent
stuff? I think that's where we've really excelled, particularly during the last 20 years or so, and have really made our mark. Yeah, definitely.
And I think just so listeners know, because we've had a couple of the guys on here. Seth has been on here before.
Okay.
Chester Brown's been on the show. Came and hung out in the studio. It was quite nice to have. And there's a bunch of other people that haven't been on it. Dave Cooper, Dave Sim, Julie Doucet. Is it Doucet? I think it's Doucet. And those are some of the...
Tomato.
Yeah, Doucet. Those are some of the really big names that are really created... These unique styles that have really, influenced the broadband of comics.
And they've actually reached beyond the comic book milieu, and a lot of them have succeeded in reaching a broader audience and have achieved some recognition outside of the comic book field, which I think is very encouraging, as particularly Chester with the Louis Riel graphic novel.
Taking the most Canadian story you can, I think.
Yeah, in many respects.
It really speaks to the Canadian identity.
Yeah.
It seems to me that Canadian alternative cartoonists have been influential in the United States without anybody really knowing they're Canadian half the time.
I think that's true.
So do you think, I know this is the question you probably get asked all the time, is there a Canadian comics identity, particularly in the alternative comics?
That is a question I get asked all the time, and it's a very difficult one to answer. Because I think if you look at, I kind of point to the contemporary period and say, well, there's three currents at work here right now. And that would be what I call mainstream comics, which is, basically U.S. superhero comics. And then we have alternative comics. And then we have small press. And, Canadians are working on sort of both sides of the border in those fields, right? All three of them. And I think that Canadians are... Is there something unique about our contribution to mainstream comics, to superhero comics? Probably not. Is there something unique about our participation in the small press? I don't know. I'm not sure that there is. Colin, I'd be interested in your opinion on that. And when it comes to alternative comics, I'm just not sure that there is. We have an important voice. There's no question about that.
Well, I gotta say,
but if you look at our actors, you look at our musicians, writers. People are that North American cultural milieu is just. It's hard to distinguish, a definite Canadian current in some of those things, a distinct one. I think if you look at Drawn and Quarterly, they certainly. The people that were clustered around Drawn and Quarterly initially in the early days, Doucette and Seth and Chester Brown and Joe Matt, they certainly made their mark in the, in international comic book milieu, international comic art. I think that the Canadians were probably the first to kind of emerge with autobiographical comics, and to make their mark with those. But it, you know, I don't really know what the answer is to that question. It's a difficult one. Colin, what do you think about Canadian participation, for instance, in the small press milieu? Is there something distinct there?
Oh. I asked the questions. I'm not really sure either. I think autobiographical. I think Harvey Pekar in Cleveland was doing that before, and
that's
of course
true.
Joe Matt himself is an American.
That's true.
But
and a lot of these alternative artists that we're pointing to, right? They're,
yeah.
A lot of them are publishing with American publishers.
Yes.
I just want to make sure people know Drawn and Quarterly is actually one of the biggest, or the strongest, I won't say biggest, but strongest publishers of alternative comics. Period.
And they're from Montreal.
Yeah.
I would say something that an American friend of mine observed, that being Canadian was a lot like being Jewish, in that you could observe American culture without being part of it.
Yes.
So yeah, I think there's something perhaps more satirical.
There is a distance there, for sure.
Yeah.
We're part of it, but we're not part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah,
right.
there's certainly
satirical bent.
There's some truth to that, and that may be why one of the things that we truly excel at is satire, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess
because we do have a different perspective, and we like to prod and poke a bit too. And feel superior, right?
Well, we are.
But that's actually our secret.
I've noticed, actually, that one of the things Canadians do is they go around decrying how smug Canadians are, which is kind of a funny thing to do if you're really smug.
It's true.
But I don't know. I think it's kind of a... It's almost like the survival humor that you find in marginalized groups, like First Nations humor or whatever. Like, it's very self-deprecating, but at
yeah.
the same time, it's... It's poking fun at the establishment that's
yeah.
kind of crapping on your front lawn.
I love self-deprecation.
Yeah.
I think part of the thing with small press comics, too, especially in Canada, because the population is so sparse, it's a distribution issue.
Yeah.
So it's hard for there to be some sort of cohesive kind of vision to gel.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I don't think we actually have. I mean, if you look at other areas of our culture as well, I'm not sure. And I'm from Nova Scotia, and I'm... you know, very much aware of this. We have a series of regional cultures that are extremely strong.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm not sure we have a national culture or a national, for instance, in literature. I'm not sure we've got a national literature. We've got a lot of really people who are extremely important within their regions.
Right.
You know, some of the writers who might be, who I would point to as sort of the giants of Canadian literature might be people that no one's ever heard of because my interest is in Atlantic literature in terms of literary history. And certainly in the small press, that's very true, right? I mean, there is some communication through some of the zines, but generally the review zines and
mm-hmm.
websites. But generally speaking, if you travel the country, they're very vibrant local scenes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
And there are people making their mark in these scenes and who are giants in these scenes who most people would be unaware of if you weren't in that particular region.
I think exemplified in Vancouver, someone like Mark Bell and like Keith Jones and stuff being published by Drawn and Quarterly, kind of sticking out from the Vancouver scene, but that's like only a segment of the population.
What about someone like a David Boswell?
Yes.
He's regional too?
I would say David, actually, no, he's transcended that.
But he hasn't done anything in a while.
But I'm thinking more in terms of the self-published comics, the digests and the minis, you're only going to see in local comic book shops. And
mm-hmm.
no, there are people that will transcend that and gain national and maybe even international recognition.
But I mean, like, you know, not to critique John and Corley, but they are very much a Montreal type publisher. Like, they're
definitely
they're good to look like. It's Montreal.
Well, they do a lot of international artists as well.
But you look at their Canadian selection; it's all East Coast, except for Mark and Keith. And they have a new book. I forget her name. It's a Vancouver artist coming out.
Oh.
But in that, it's, you know, you've got Michelle Rebecliotti.
Yeah.
You know, well, Julie, but she's awesome. Seth, and there's a whole.
Well, he's in an enviable position there because he's able to draw. I mean, Montreal, the comic book milieu is just completely unique within North America and always has been, because you've got this exposure to the European, the French, and other European comics, and they've got the same exposure that we have to the American comics, and then they've got a very vibrant English, Canadian, Montreal Anglo comics scene as well, and even the British English comics, and you know, there's a real mixing of traditions in Montreal that you probably wouldn't see anywhere else.
I'm gonna throw in a quick music break.
Okay,
we're about half past. Any song off the Clash album you want to hear?
I'm not down.
You know what, that's actually funny enough. It's a song I had queued up just in case. So there we go. Inkstuds, we'll be right back with our guest John Bell and my boys.
I've been beat up, I've been thrown out, but I'm not down, no I'm not down.
No, he's not down. Inkstead, CITR 101.9 FM. I started out with the wrong song and got slapped vigorously by my co-host for today. I'll do a quick reminder of people. Colin Upton is joining me. Colin Upton is a legend in the small press mini comic industry. Basically, a man that knows his way around a photocopy machine. And Ken Bozum can be seen every week. Every 2 weeks in Extra West and
Extra in Ottawa.
Capital Extra in Ottawa. Yeah. And Ken will be back for I haven't interviewed Ken yet, and he is one of Vancouver's guys, so he will be back sometime soon. Just a couple Inkstuds thing to do with our conversation we're having today. Joe Matt will be our guest next week.
Ooh.
And I think that'll be a good show. And then next month we'll have Brian Ralph on December 6th. December 13th will be Frank Centoro. Brilliant stuff from Pitcherbox. And December 20th, Jonathan Dalton, local kid from Langley, is going to come in. And he's got a thing coming out. It's in an anthology. I can't remember the name right now. But you can pick up his mini comics at Better Comic Stores. As well as mini comics by both of you gentlemen.
Mm.
At Better Comic Stores. And if they don't carry mini comics, walk out. I'm serious. You know, it's the lifeblood of the comics world. And that's where you see a lot of the new interesting stuff. Now, John, who are you? Let's get a little biographical information on you.
Well, I'm an archivist by trade. And I work at Library and Archives Canada. And born in Montreal, raised in Halifax, and I've been living in Ottawa since 82. And I'm interested in various aspects of Canada's popular culture and literary history, including comics, of course.
So what kind of stuff do you normally deal with in the library archives? Has there been a lot of carryover at the
Commons? I've been seconded to work on several comics-related projects at Library and Archives Canada.
Nice.
And that's been a real pleasure for me. Also, during the course of my research for Kinect Comics and Invaders, I amassed a fairly large collection of Canadian comics. And I donated that to the rare books section of the National Library. So it's now available for other people to work on. But normally at the Library and Archives, I work on politicians' papers.
Wow.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Sounds like carryover with what I take in school. I'm a poli-sci guy at school, so.
Oh, okay.
There we go. Not that anyone cares about me. I care about the guests. So, Colin had a question.
Yeah?
Yeah. I was just wondering, you were talking earlier about how the comic scene in Canada is so local. Have you ever been out to research the Vancouver scene in depth?
I have not, I'm ashamed to say.
No.
Saskatoon's as far west as I've ever been.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, doing stuff on David Collier, but, you know, Rand Holmes isn't good enough?
I know. Hey, he's a Nova Scotian, too.
Rand Holmes or...
Rand Holmes.
Originally, yeah.
Oh.
And just so people know, there is a Rand Holmes being worked on right now by Patrick Rosencrantz, who was on a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that book.
Yeah, no, sure.
And he's come to Vancouver.
No, I'm ashamed to say I haven't been there.
Well, if you ever do, we'll be happy to show you around.
Good stuff. I'll look forward to that.
Colin is a veritable wealth of information of Canadian or Vancouver comicsopia,
I guess,
is a good terminology. Now, speaking of Rand Holmes, Canada had a pretty vibrant underground scene, which a lot of people don't really know about, but Rand Holmes is pretty important. Cartoonists.
Yes.
What were some of the more interesting, important underground comics from the 70s of Canadiana?
Well, the interesting thing about the underground scene was that it kind of emerged in, apart from Vancouver, which was an obvious center because it was really a center of the underground press with the Georges Strait and other publications. But the other sort of centers of underground activity, again, apart from Montreal, which a lot of that stuff was appearing en français, Saskatoon was a major center because of Dave Geary. And Ottawa, as unlikely as that might seem, where there was a newsstand underground called Fuddle Duddle, that appeared during that same period. But of course, I think Vancouver, if you had to point to one particular place, it was Vancouver with Brent Boats and Rand Holmes. Those guys were
Fog
were
City Comics
in that field. What's that?
Fog City Comics.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was so interesting about Rand Holmes? Or everyone's kind of.
Well, I just think he was. Dave Sim has talked about him on his blog, and he has some interesting comments about Holmes. But one of the things he. I think what really distinguishes him is he lived and breathed this stuff. That was his life, you know, in mm-hmm. many ways. And he stayed true to those values for his entire life. That's impressive. He was an extremely accomplished artist.
That's pretty good. Addition to the strips,
worked through some back files of George Strait and look at the covers he produced.
Yeah, they're amazing.
They're absolutely gorgeous. This book on him is going to be an eye-opener for a lot of people, I'm sure.
Yeah, because he wasn't even allowed back in the States after a certain point, so his career, his underground career got kind of limited because of legal transgressions. Is that a good way of putting it?
But a major figure in Canadian comic art. You know, one of the giants, really.
I actually got depressed last year at one point because my strip had been running for about a year and I was reading about Rand Holmes and discovered that I was getting paid less than he got paid in 1972.
Yeah, that is depressing.
Oh.
But I got a raise, so it's okay.
Hey, man. Look at what Rand Holmes got. And his strip sparked a little controversy.
Harold Head.
Harold Head.
What was some of the controversy that came from that? Anyone?
He ran up against the mayor in Vancouver, didn't he? The Strait get into some trouble with the mayor at the time?
Yeah, the mayor and the police in Vancouver were trying to shut the Strait, and it was sort of a very anti-hippie atmosphere from the establishment, and so the mayor and
the man?
The man,
yeah.
Is often portrayed as a porcine police officer. And Harold Head comes to cause him grief all the time.
Yeah, you should see the Georgia Strait now.
Yeah, the Georgia Strait now is nothing like it was.
It's
then,
rather tame, I think, eh?
Yeah.
Not so many counterculture revolutionaries working
not so much.
The underground guys were important, too, because they paved the way for the alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
They're still
they broke all the taboos. They broke all the rules. And then, about towards the at the end of the... it's just as the underground period ends that you see the emergence of the early alternative comics.
And I guess a name we've already mentioned, or you mentioned, that's really important is Dave Sim.
Yes.
As far as like being that bridging gap between the modern alternative and the underground, which comes in the odd form of a barbarian aardvark.
Yes. Dave's also he forms another kind of bridge as well, and it represents one, rather, in that he's very active in the early Canadian comic book fandom that begins to merge in the early 70s. And he's an editor, he's a writer. He first comes to prominence as a writer. And this is Dave Sim is like, he's probably 15, 16 at this point. And
not so filled with
he's
hate.
He's written some, even that early, he was writing some extremely insightful and important stuff. And interviewing some of the Golden Age artists and connecting with them. And
I don't even know that part about Dave Sim, that he was doing that kind of stuff as a young gent.
Yeah, 73, 74, in through there. He's a very important Canadian fan editor and writer.
And I think for people listening, one of the important things about Dave is he really pushed forward a revolution of do-it-yourself.
Yes, he did.
Self-published.
Yeah.
I just like the do-it-yourself line. DIY, man. Continued to do so, much to his success and the failure of others, I think was one thing that might be noted is that he championed the cause, but not so many followed through as well.
No. Dave accomplished an incredible amount, and I'm sure he still will. I think it, I mean, he's still a fairly young guy. I think he's got a lot more to say and do.
Cerebus
is an extraordinary accomplishment in every way.
300 issues total.
Monthly.
Yeah.
Were they monthly?
Stuck to schedule, too, yeah.
Yeah.
It was monthly.
He had an end date, and he made that end date.
Yeah.
Which is remarkable for an alternative comic, which is done... Well, at the beginning, he did it by himself, and then
he
had help with Gerhard.
Yeah.
And he also had editorial help from Diana Schutz for many years until a hate-filled diatribe. I'm not going to skirt around the truth. I'm going to be honest. He ruffled some feathers. I've just caused this awkward silence going everywhere. You know, I do think Dave Sims is an important cartoonist, but I also don't think we should gloss over
the crazy bits.
Yeah, I think that's important, and you can't say thing. You know, you got to hold all together. This is a person, take and leave it. And I enjoy Dave Sims' work. I have all the Cerebuses at home. You know, taking up a whole bookshelf. Shelf and stuff. So,
what Dave's done is, and it comes as like a huge shock, I think, to a lot of people. He's articulated a very conservative position on certain issues, and it's one that I think a lot of people perhaps find shocking. But he's thought it out, and he has, you know, I think he's entitled to his opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think, but I don't think anyone has to, you know, I think that, I find it interesting though that, that sort of contrarian voice is, caused so much, there's been such a violent reaction to it. But I think that it's caused a lot of people to overlook his achievements and his accomplishments, and probably, you know, it's going to take a historical perspective to really to judge what he's done with Cerebus.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that he remains, a very important figure in the history of our comics.
I'm not angry with him or anything. It's just that I think it's reading his work and what he achieved with Cerebus and how he ended it. It felt like he was leaving a bad smell on his legacy, on his work at the end of it, with not just conservative opinions, but opinions that seemed disconnected with the real world.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to completely change topics now because we're all kind of mopey. Chester Brown. Chester Brown's a big feature of your book.
Yes.
And I think we're all going to agree. We mentioned before his importance. What was it about Chester Brown that really struck you as the need to do a big focus? Or I guess spotlight is the way you put it in the book.
Well, yeah, spotlight or focus. I decided that in addition to doing the thematic exploration of superheroes, it would be interesting to focus on a single creator and do an in-depth study. And I had trouble, frankly, choosing one individual. And, you know, I think there were other artists. Dave Sim would be one who I could have focused on. But I decided it would be Chester because of the breadth of his work and the daring that was evident in his comics. And I also thought the whole, you know, that the trajectory of his career is so fascinating, where, you know, he goes from a superhero fan and rejection by the mainstream publishers, DC and Marvel, then through to the small press, where he becomes, you know, one of the giants of that milieu, and then makes the transition to alternative comics and sticks with it. And I thought that in many ways his story is a story of modern Canadian comics, certainly Canadian comics in the last 20 years. But even more than Dave, in a sense, because Sim Sim is important within the comic book milieu, extremely important. But he never really broke out of that milieu. He never really reached an audience beyond it. And I think that Chester did do that.
Just so people kind of understand a little background on the work of Chester, like his early stuff was, I guess, surreal, the best way of putting it?
Extremely, yeah.
Yummy Furs, Ed the Happy Clown, An Odd Tale, where this weird, sad, depressing clown whose body's just breaking on him somehow ends up with Ronald Reagan's head as the head of his phallus, and just goes into a whole odd thing. It's very, very, very odd and surreal, but still beautiful.
Well, now you
done.
Have a sense of how difficult it was for me to describe the plot of Yummy Fur. I mean, oh my God!
I'm trying to do it on air.
It's breathtaking.
Yeah.
Yet they're like dream narratives, but there's enough coherence there that it all kind of holds together, and makes sense. It's a remarkable achievement. It was just stunning at the time to read these digest comics as they came out. It was like, what's he going to do next?
And I think that's just it. It really blew a lot of people away, and it was an interesting balance. He has that. And then I'm not sure when the Tales of Jesus came in, where he'd actually be interpreting Gospels. I don't know if that came in when he started doing the autobio stuff.
About the same time, I think.
And his autobio stuff was some of the more personal, introspective autobio work you'll come across, because Harvey Pekar's got a certain thing where it's like, I'm Harvey Pekar, and this is my crazy life, and these are my crazy friends. And Chester Brown's work wasn't about being Chester Brown. It was about, this is what I've gone through.
Yeah.
Chester Brown, when he was looking back when he was a kid.
Yeah. And then he had some other stuff that was modern day stuff, but it wasn't so character centric as him being such a character. It was just more honest.
I think the most striking thing about those narratives would be the honesty. I mean, they're extremely powerful books, and probably among the very best autobiographical comics ever published.
I think we'll all agree.
And then there was Underwater.
And then there was Underwater, which he had
kind of lost his way there.
Which was a step back into surrealism, I guess, where he had these odd alien beings that slowly were developing a human, developing to be able to speak English. But it turned out he was looking at it and like, wow, this is going to take 300 issues to do what I want.
And I saw someone else do that, and maybe I don't want to do it.
Yeah, you saw what happened.
But I could see Chester going back to that stuff eventually and piecing it together in a way that will make us want to read it. I could see that happening.
I had a theory about that comic. I wondered if it was perhaps an attempt from him by Chester to try and look at the world from his mother's point of view, because she was schizophrenic when looking at it from the point of view as a child of developing.
Yeah.
Thus the visions.
Good point, actually. That you might be onto something there.
And I said the schizophrenia is a topic that he works with a lot.
Yeah.
Knowing or unknowingly or intentingly or unintentingly.
Well, directly at one point.
Yeah, directly at one point.
Right.
But I can't remember when we had him on, we discussed the use of mental health and Louis Riel and stuff, and if that was the reason for picking Louis Riel. I don't think it was the reason. It just happened to be a part of the reason.
Yeah.
And then just that was his follow-up to all this like incredible autobio work, was, you know, this groundbreaking historical drama.
Yeah.
Very definite emphasis on drama. It's a very dry piece of work. Beautifully done, incredibly done, but it's purposefully dry.
Yeah.
The Louis Riel, you mean?
Yeah. It's gorgeous, though. It's, it's an artist definitely at the top of his game. I want to talk a little bit. We have about 5 minutes left, and I think someone that doesn't really get discussed much anymore, but used to, one of the more important Canadian cartoons, Julie Doucet.
Yes.
Or Doucette.
Doucette.
Who really struck a chord as a female cartoonist doing something that's so unique and profound. I don't know if I want to use that term.
I think it was.
I guess, is that That's a. Do you guys agree? Any comments? Mm-hmm. They're just flipping through the book right now.
Well, I think again, it was like Chester. She was fearless, right?
Mm-hmm.
That took a lot of courage to write and draw that stuff. I think she was willing to go to the edge and then over, and the stuff was brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
But she seemed to run out of steam after a while.
She did.
I think that's just it. Yeah. She told her stories.
She may have told all her stories. The other thing is that, you know, I kind of wonder if, as our alternative artists, some of our alternative artists move more and more towards mainstream publishing and, you know, big New York publishers and recognition by people outside the comics field, there could very well be a temptation for a lot of them to cross over into art, just art, or fine art, if you will.
Or lowbrow art.
Yeah.
Don't like that term.
But if you look at contemporary art practice, there's a lot of stuff that looks like comic book graphics now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
If you look at artist books, you know, there's a kind of a merger going on there. So maybe at a certain point, some artists are going to say, well, would I rather be an artist with a capital A, or would I rather be a comic book artist?
So.
And maybe I don't need to focus so much on narrative anymore. Maybe I'm more interested in simply creating art.
Is that what Julie's doing these days?
Well, she was for a time. Now, what she's doing now, I'm not sure. But yeah, she was. I think she was doing prints and various other things. She was more active as an artist outside of comics.
And the funny thing, though, is her books are still being published by comic publishers.
Yes, that's right.
Drawn Quarterly is publishing her next book, 365, yep. Which actually
is a comic.
And
maybe she's being lured back. But I know that Dave Cooper has a fine art career underway right now too, and I think he'll still be doing comics.
I thought his story Ripple was kind of his. Here's the book I've been working out to be able to do, and here it is, and I'm done.
Yeah, that could
be. And kind of stepping back.
He has a show opening here in Ottawa, before it goes to L.A. Tomorrow night, actually.
Oh, nice.
It's a vernissage.
I'm very jealous.
Yeah.
I love
but
Dave
I know
Cooper
he's
stuff.
Had shows in, I think, Philadelphia. He's had a couple in Los Angeles. And so he's painting now.
Mm-hmm.
I assume he's still doing some work as a graphic artist and a comic book artist. But
well, he just had a children's book come out.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's under a different name, though, because, who would want their a mother looking up? Oh, this is a wonderful book, and looking
what
up.
What else has he done? Yeah.
Oh my God, that's filthy.
Yeah.
He's on the cover of your book, vomiting comic book characters.
That's true. A lot of people have been offended by that cover.
Really?
It. Yeah.
I love it.
I know.
I think it's great.
But you're alternative comics guy.
Yeah,
you don't know. You didn't know. You don't know that you should be offended.
How is the book doing?
Show it to your parents. What's that?
How is the book doing?
It's doing very well.
Oh, good.
Excellent.
Good.
Yeah, I'm very pleased with it.
And when are you going to come out with an update to past the 80s into the 90s and today?
For Canuck Comics?
Yeah.
I've got that set aside. What I've done is I did update Canuck Comics, and I've got a listing that takes Canadian comics up to the end of, I think it's 89. And it adds hundreds and hundreds of titles to the original volume. But from 89 on, this takes us back to our conversation about the local scenes. It would be impossible for any one individual to document all the mini comics and zines, comic zines, that have appeared in Canada since say, 90, right?
Yeah.
It would be a major
Colin.
Collective.
Colin just wants to see his stuff in a price guide.
I want to know what Happy Ned. Right. I want to know what Happy Ned is worth now. Number one.
Okay.
$350.
I'll send you a note.
So, what can we look forward to next by you?
Well, actually, I'm leaving comics behind for a while.
What?
I'm going to do some different stuff. Yeah, I'm currently working on a book on Confederate naval commandos on the Great Lakes.
Colin's eyes just bulge in joy.
What? There's no such thing.
Oh, yeah.
Confederate commandos on the Great Lakes?
Naval commandos, yeah.
Wow, this is an untold...
63, 64.
Wow.
1863.
Wow. I heard about the bank robbers, but...
Yeah, no, they were on the Great Lakes as well. It's a great story.
Well, we look forward to seeing it. I'm sure I'll have some class where I'll be taking it.
It's a good comic, too.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Colin's next mini comic. Thanks so much for joining us today, John.
It was my pleasure.
By the way, did you get the last package I sent you?
Yes, thank you very much. Absolutely delightful. Great stuff.
Thanks,
Colin.
Okay, take care.
Thanks, John.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We ran out of time there. Unfortunately, it is 3 o'clock, and I have a bunch of angry hip-hop guys looking at me in the hallway all ready to kick my ass. Actually, they're not.
They're shaking their fists.
No, Colin's shaking his fist at them, like trying to shake a... rattle an animal in a cage. So, Ink Studs next week, Brian Ralph, Frank Santoro, all these great shows coming up. And don't forget Ink Studs Art Show coming in January. Go to inkstuds.com to check out the information.
Are you in that?
I'm not in it, but I'm going.
Oh.
This will be the first one. There's a lot of people that aren't in it that should.
Yeah, it's a small space.
And it'll be a drunken good time. Even Colin will have a drink. Just kidding.